good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for coming early in the morning to sit in a movie theater and listen to someone talk to you in English for 45 minutes. My colleagues joked that in order to really prepare for this conference, I should learn Czech. It wasn't going so well, so we decided we might as well do it in English. So a little outline of what I'm going to talk about today. I will first give an introduction about myself. Then I'll talk about why do we want to know our users in the first place. Then what does it mean to know our users? What do we want to know about our users? How do we come to know our users? What helps us understand our users? And then I'm happy to have any questions from the audience. So as you can tell, the theme we have here is knowing our users. I am an employee of Sun, and I'm a user researcher. So I'm not a designer, nor am I a developer. My degree is in sociology. I'm a sociologist. And basically, Sun employs me to talk to people, to do user research, so to find out what it is people want from the applications they use, from the products they're interested in. And then I and Jakub, whom you will hear from later, spend a lot of our time talking to different product teams within Sun and trying to make the connections between our users and our product teams. So, why do we want to know our users? So, I'm assuming, hopefully correctly, that most of the people in the audience are designers and developers, and maybe a few sort of odd sorts in that area. So, we design and develop in our work for a subset of people, right? We don't design for everyone, we design for a subset. And this subset is our users. We build, we code, we design, we sketch, we create animations for our users. And we want to please our users. We want the things that we design and develop to excite them, to satisfy them, to make our users happy and willing to pay, usually, for the product. And to please our users, we need to know them. It's our basic motivation. So what does it mean to know our users? So I've given here a very basic definition of to know according in English. So it's to perceive directly, is the first definition, to be acquainted or familiar with, or to have experience of. On a complete side note, one of the things that's interesting about English and to know is that English only has one word for it. In the other sort of languages I speak, both Dutch and French, there are two words for it, but English has only come up with one, and we'll see if it's enough. So we can't know everything about our users. People are complex, right? So often when we think, okay, we're on a product and we think, oh, I have to know my users, we don't actually want to know everything about them. They might be at the center of our focus, but we don't want to know necessarily everything about their children, everything about their entire workday, where they have lunch, how much they travel. In some instances, it's very important, but not all of these things are important when we think about knowing our users. So what is it that we want to know about our users in the first place? Is that our desired effect? Yeah? All right. We actually want to know very little about our users in the end. As I said, people are very complex, and there are all these things about them, but we actually want to know very few things about them. The challenge in all of our work, in all of our design work, our development work, our research work, is figuring out exactly what it is we want to know about the users. Again, we don't want to know everything. We want to know specific things, usually what their goals are, what their particular needs around our product is, what they like, what they might not like. We might want to know things like how often they look for code snippets online. That comes up very much in the research that we do. What their workflow is, right? If they're creating interactive application, what is their workflow process? In what language they program, code, script? Perhaps how old they are, depending on, for example, if you're working on a particular website. Whether or not they want to be at the website they're visiting. You know, we have an assumption that people arrive at websites wanting to be there, where oftentimes they're actually just rushing to get something done, and they don't necessarily want to be enjoying for hours and hours the experience of that particular website. How large their companies are, and what products they buy online. These are small examples of just the types of things that we may want to know about our users. Again, not everything about them. I keep emphasizing that because I think sometimes when we talk about knowing our users, we easily get overwhelmed and we think, oh, there's no way I can know everything about the users. Where actually it's just important to know exactly a few things. So how we come to know our users. This is just sort of a survey of research methods. Not everyone uses all of them. Not all of them are suitable for every occasion. I'll just run through them sort of briefly. I'm guessing that some of you are familiar with some of them and not others. But these are some of the ones that we use at Sun and also have used in other sort of places. Survey questionnaires, which are the most straightforward. Long questionnaires where you answer questions. You know, fill in the blank, rank something from 1 to 5. In-depth interviews, so where you're actually talking face-to-face with one person and asking them questions about what their needs are. Contextual inquiry, so often you're in the workplace or the home, depending on what you're designing, and you're seeing the user actually operate in their own environment, and you ask them questions as they go along. Shadowing or participant observation. For example, we may want to follow a system administrator around a data center for a day. So instead of asking him a lot of questions, you actually just follow him around for a day and see what tasks he performs, whom he talks to, what problems he faces, what his challenges are. Heuristic evaluation. So in this case, you're using a set of rules, sort of analytical rules, and comparing them to what you're seeing. This is often used in website evaluations. Usability studies, often taking place in a lab. So mirrored glass, usually participant on one side, other people observing on the other, and you sort of observe them as they go through tasks. Personas, much discussed again in the web space, ideas of creating profiles, in quotes, that can be used to move design forward. Taxonomy exercises, so if you have a particularly complicated navigation scheme, for example, on a website, you can go through an exercise of card sorting or working through taxonomy. Testing prototypes, so early paper prototypes, early mock-ups that you actually just want to put in front of people and get feedback from. Focus groups, 5 to 10 people in a room, picking particular topics, getting a group discussion going. And then cluster segmentation. So that's when you're taking a large population and you're splitting them up in a way that makes sense. It could be the early adopters, it could be the late adopters. So I put a little star by some of these methods and put their common marketing techniques. So one of the things about knowing our users that I think as user researchers we often face is people say, well, isn't what you're doing marketing? Certainly some of the techniques that user research relies on are common marketing techniques. So the survey questionnaire, cluster segmentation, and focus groups. However, the major difference is that the kinds of questions you're asking when you really want to know your users are very different than the kinds of questions you're asking when you really want to sell to your users. We're in the service of moving design and development forward as user researchers. We're usually not in the business of trying to sell. Of course, the two are related. Nobody's naive. But the kinds of questions you might ask a system administrator when you're interested in their workflow are very different than the kinds of questions you might ask a system administrator that you want to buy something. So, what helps us understand users? Rather than present with a really long list of things, what I've done basically is come up with sort of 4 things that help us understand and learn to know the user, and then provided some examples. Part of the trick of doing this kind of presentation is because we're not doing design, I don't have a million wonderful screenshots to show you of what the work is. User research is often very invisible. It's often done very quietly. It's often unacknowledged. It's hidden in the background, and so it's hard to see, it's hard to show you something that says, oh, this is what knowing your users mean. You usually see the end result in the design or the development or the product. So the first thing I've written is that remembering that users might be different than us, different than the people we are, or than people we actually know. And I have two examples in this arena. So Sony introduced the Walkman. I think some of the audience at least was born at the time that this existed. And it was the first product that Sony introduced. So out of Japan, they decided to create the Walkman. And one of the things that went along with creating this Walkman is a cultural assumption about how people would experience music. So this is the original design of the Walkman. It's a cassette recorder. I don't have a pointer, but as you can see from the right, playing cassette tapes. And what you can see from the image on your left is that there are two headphone jacks in it, right? The designers of this original Sony Walkman made the assumption that people listening to music would want it to be a shared experience. Their vision of the Walkman would be that two people would be sitting next to each other, each of them having a headset on, and listen to the Walkman together and to the same music. And some of the early designs even accounted for, let's say that I'm sitting next to Jakub and we're both listening to the same music, and then we want to talk to each other. Some of the early designs included a button that you could press to stop the music, so then Jakub and I could talk to each other. Implicit in this design was that people would want to share. So they released this model. I mean, they released the Walkman in Japan as well, but they released it in the UK, so in the United Kingdom. And they found that nobody liked the double jacks, that the double headphones seemed like a ridiculous idea to anyone who used the Walkman. The assumption in the United Kingdom was that listening to music, particularly on this little device, was a very individual experience. To all of us now with our iPods, this seems really obvious, right? Wearing an iPod, having your headphones on is a way to often escape people. It's to sit on the subway and not talk to anyone, to be protected in this kind of way. It's not a shared experience. But the Japanese understanding of the Walkman and of music and of the Japanese social experience was that music should be shared. After this first model, they actually got rid of the dual jacks. The second example is, again, along these lines of don't make the assumption that people are just like you. So another thing about user research is that it's often proprietary information. So some of the examples I'll give are don't mention any companies in specific. So this is the story of a large international company, which is not Sun, who's in the business of creating appliances. So one of the product marketing teams and engineering teams said that they wanted to build an internet appliance that could be used in kitchens. So the idea was, rather than have a computer, which seemed like an expensive, costly item, they wanted to break into the Asian market, into Southeast Asia, by having internet appliances. And the idea was that a kitchen internet appliance would be the perfect thing. So what they did is they actually sent a team of user researchers to do some research in Asia, led by a pretty well-known anthropologist. They did their fieldwork, they came back. This anthropologist made the presentation to the engineering team, and the presentation basically consisted of 25 slides. And on each of the slides, she had one picture. And each picture was a different picture of a kitchen in China, in Korea, and in India. And as you went through the 25 images, what you saw is that the assumption about what a kitchen was very different in these countries, right? It looked a lot more like the images I'm showing you. Without the room for an internet appliance, sometimes without an electrical socket that you would need for an internet appliance, and without the even need or interest in having that kind of device in one's kitchen, of all places. Tended to be smoky, unventilated rooms. Before this researcher went on the project was already budgeted for several million dollars. They were committed to doing this kind of research, this kind of product. Understandably, when the anthropologists came back, they canceled the project with this data. But it's an example of how the assumptions of the people who were thinking, okay, it's a new market, we can build this, conflicted with what people's actual needs were. And this was only apparent because someone had done the research beforehand. So the second thing is that you're probably more familiar with what you create than your users are. But that doesn't make your users stupid. So I mentioned this example because I work in a technology company, and I work in a technology company that does a lot of Java. And I've been on several projects throughout my career at Sun where we have a discussion that looks like this. We're designing a tool, we're redesigning a website aimed at developers, and I say, well, let's see what our users want. And the product team says to me, we know what the users want, we are the users. Yeah, there's some laughs because we've all had this conversation in different kinds of contexts, right? I am the users are me, why should I look anywhere else? So about 3 or 4 years ago, there was a, well, maybe even longer now, there was a redesign of a particular site dealing with Java developers. And there was some debate on the team I was on about how we should redesign certain elements of the website. So we had this conversation, which someone said, well, I am the users, we are Java developers. We have a very clear idea of what it is that people want. So one of the things that I did in terms of research is I went around and asked a bunch of questions of Sun employees, and then I found some survey data. And so I focused and presented the question on, when we think about people's programming time, who spends 100% of their programming time programming in Java? Well, when you talk to Sun employees who use Java, 100% of them, roughly, spend 100% of their time coding Java. As soon as you're not talking to Sun employees, only 6% of people spend 100% of their time coding in Java. The bottom line is that Sun employees who use Java know a hell of a lot more about Java than the average person coding in Java. Why this was important is because some of the things we were thinking about in the site, the product team thought were obvious, and that anyone would be able to figure this out. And if they didn't, if the person couldn't figure it out, they were stupid. They were novices. They were inexperienced. When actually looking and understanding and knowing who the users actually were showed that they were actually perhaps not stupid, perhaps not novice, just it wasn't their full-time job. This was not the only thing they thought about, and therefore they had a different perspective and had different needs. And so the last bullet point there, I said, your users may not know your product as well as you do, and so you need to figure out how much and what they know. And you know, this is an example from sort of working with developers at Sun, but you can easily, I hope, see the examples that might be relevant in your work. If you're thinking about website design, for example, you will spend a lot more time thinking about the design of the particular website than anyone who visits it. The people who visit it will spend a fraction of their time looking at it and trying to solve their problem. And you will have spent weeks, months, years perhaps, depending on the site, knowing the ins and outs. And what's important to remember in that is that people, just because they don't know as much as you do or don't have the depth or maybe aren't interested as you are, it doesn't mean that they're stupid or can be pushed aside. A third point is what helps us understand users. So it's a little crude, but I always think of this as asking questions, then shutting up, then listening to the answers, and then repeating the process. And the example I'll talk about here is from some work that we did around personas at Sun. And it's a very good example of this cycle of asking questions, shutting up, listening, and repeating. It's an iterative process. You start, you do it once, you reevaluate, you do it again until you're convinced that you have captured the whole story. So, Sun Learning Services is the group within Sun that's responsible for training. So it sells products to people who want to learn how to use Sun's hardware or Sun's software. It's a valuable part of the business. And they came to the group I'm in, the Software User Experience Group, X-Design, and basically wanted some help. And they wanted some help roughly around how to offer better products to people who wanted training. So the people who did the training came to us and said, help, we need to understand who these people are taking our training. So the first thing that another interaction designer and I did was we asked questions of the people who did the training. So we asked the trainers a whole bunch of questions. What they thought was important about the training, what in their experience seemed to work, what didn't seem to work, what seemed completely uninteresting to users, what seemed very interesting to users. We asked the questions, we then stopped talking, and then we listened. We took the answers that the clients gave, in this case our training people, and then went to the target users and conducted a large survey. So if any of you are familiar with persona work, it's a little bit of a different approach. Rather than doing interviews first, we did a large-scale survey. We surveyed several thousand people who'd actually taken them at some point, and we asked them about their experience of the course, but also their general experience, what they had certifications in, a range of questions about their skills, their desires, how they spent their time, those kinds of questions. Conducted the survey. By listening to their answers here, I mean we actually analyzed the data. And then we were confused. We presented these initial results to our clients who said, well, this might be statistically accurate, but it doesn't map to what we know of the world. So what did we do? We started the process again. We went back and asked questions of the target users, and instead of doing a large survey, we did interviews. We took a random sample of our survey respondents, and we did interviews with them and asked follow-up questions, asked things like, you said that you did X. Did you really do that, or do you really do Y? And we got some more accurate answers. We got richer pictures of what people actually did in their everyday work. And then we were able, once we heard that, to incorporate it into our personas. So what I have here is an example of one persona. It's not really possible to give you the whole persona world, but here's a snippet of it. So this is Harry Hardwick. So part of the idea in the persona work is that you make it alliterate. So Harry Hardware, I think we have Susie System Administrator to make it easier to remember. So this guy says he manages routers, patches systems, runs jump starts, manage Veritas, does a whole slew of other things. Restores Linux and Windows systems, resolves backup issues. You can see the list. He has specific goals, so to keep the business running with no downtime. He has specific challenges. Some of which are here, security, enterprise consolidation, business integration. He has particular needs around training, right? So he's interested in every sysadmin class that Sun offers, but will take other kinds of training. And he's also interested in certification, so he also has a certified by Microsoft, as well as Sun Solaris 8 sysadmin. But he actually has the desire to get certified for Solaris, but his employer isn't asking for it. One of the strengths of what this kind of persona was able to do is that the people at Sun responsible for training were able to take these personas and tie them to how they started to offer training. So instead of relying on, yes, I was very satisfied with my Solaris 10 training, they were able to say, okay, we have actual profiles of what people want in their training. And we have ways of offering them new information, and we can actually tie the way that we sell our training to these kinds of personas. But this is an instance of, if we had stopped at the first time that we had asked questions, shut up and listened, we wouldn't have gotten as rich results. The data that we got from the interviews were able to let us tweak and make more accurate and, in the end, more useful personas. So the last slide I have here. A lot of what we do in knowing our users is we walk away with a somewhat intimate knowledge of at least their goals and their needs, right? But what we often forget is that we need to be able to describe our users to others and to advocate for them. often what we do is we internalize the information. We bring it inside, it feeds our design, but we don't often talk about it to other people. So we sometimes get to know our users, but it shouldn't stop there. We internalize it, it shows in our design and development in that invisible way that I was talking about before, that you actually know you've done the research and the only proof that it's there is in a really good design or in a really good product. But it doesn't often get acknowledged as such. And being able to describe our users to others to say, oh, this is our target audience and I know this about them, whether it's from in-depth interviews, from following them around, or from asking questions, is an important part of doing user research. And advocating, if you're allowed to, or if you have the space to, so actually arguing that the users are important and that their users' needs should sometimes be more important than whatever features someone else wants to put into the product, advocating for users' goals and their needs and their overall happiness is a responsibility of knowing. And at this point, I'm done with my presentation, and if there are any questions. Silence.
I have a question on you.
Oh, great.
So the person that you showed, is it the actual thing or is it just for a presentation? Because I've heard opinions that it should contain more of a personal level or narrative, like speaking level.
Yes, so this is an actual persona. One of the things that often gets asked around personas is how much of this narrative and what facts are relevant. It's a little bit of a technical detail, but mostly personas were created for websites. So they were created for consumer websites in particular, the whole sort of technique. So the idea was that you wanted to know whether somebody drove to work, talked on their cell phone, dropped the kids off, and then went to the office and bought a coffee, because that might be relevant to how they shopped for travel. So the narrative story was really a way to make the consumers at the other end seem real. In a lot of the sort of software application work that we do at Sun, or in other instances, that narrative becomes less relevant, or at least further away from the product that we're trying to design.